This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Istanbul takes food seriously, very seriously. And meyhane restaurants are where it all comes to life. These traditional establishments are all about community, shared plates, loud conversations, and ruckus served as part of the ritual. But take a small detour and the food starts doing something different. As innovators in the kitchen, like Chef Deniz, continue to rewrite the menu.
In Istanbul, new young chefs like me develop the Turkish cuisine, but we don't replace tradition. We give it new life.
Because in Istanbul, food never stands still.
Old flavors, new ideas.
It evolves. Slowly, confidently, one plate at a time. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name's Mike. I'm one of the producers here at The Briefing Room. And you've probably heard a lot recently about BHS, the failed high street retailer. There's been parliamentary hearings. Politicians have been arguing with Philip Green. He's the former owner of BHS. And although the shops are still open, the company is being wound down. More to the point, 11,000 jobs will go along with it. Well, here at The Briefing Room, we looked into this story and some of the issues raised by it shortly after the firm went into administration. So here's a program we recorded in May.
Good evening. Modern living made easy. That's the slogan of the retail store that for eight decades was the one on the high street that wasn't Woolworths. But BHS, British Home Stores, went into administration last month, putting 11,000 jobs in danger and revealing a pension fund deficit of £571 million. Modern living made pretty difficult. Recrimination drowned out lamentation. The finger of blame, as wielded by Frank Field MP, chairman of the Commons Work and Pensions Committee, was pushed into the shoulder of the former boss of BHS, Sir Philip Green, who sold the company for £1 last spring. The accusation is that the unbelievably wealthy Sir Philip handed over BHS to a cowboy outfit and washed his hands of the consequences. Mr. Field said Sir Philip should stump up the £500 million pension deficit himself or lose his knighthood. Cash for keeping honours, if you like. But Sir Philip has his defenders. Don't blame him, they argue. Blame inexorable retail trends. He might be mouthy and extravagant, but what the tycoon did is what many others would have done in his position. So, which is it? Heartless asset stripping or just the market at work? Step inside the briefing room with me and let's try and work it out. Round the briefing room table are top pensions consultant John Ralph, a Conservative member of the Work and Pensions Committee Jeremy Quinn, and before we hear from them, briefing room reporter Mike Wendling, who's going to take me through the history of this debacle. Mike, the ancient among us, noted the reappearance of an old phrase this week, the unacceptable face of capitalism.
Yeah, that's right. Not spoken, of course, by Edward Heath, but this time by Conservative MP Richard Fuller, talking about Philip Green. Sir Philip bought BHS in the year 2000, sold it and lost £200 million on the deal. Sounds like a terrible business move. But, and it's a big but, over the years, money was taken out of the company in the form of dividends, fees, other payments. And questions have also been raised about the people who he sold it to.
Now, first, remind us all briefly about the history of BHS.
It started with one shop in South London in 1928. The idea was low cost, that there would be a maximum price, 1 shilling at the start. But BHS really took off in the 70s and the 80s, when department stores were the kinds of things that shoppers really wanted. In the late 1980s, as part of the Storehouse Group, it was a member of the FTSE 100, a retail giant, one of the biggest public corporations in Britain.
A giant now brought low. So I guess the question is, what happened?
Well, to find out a little bit more about that, I asked retail expert Catherine Shuttleworth.
The thing about BHS is it was a retailer that sold lots of things in what we call different categories. So sold products as varied as homewares and clothing. And it did used to sell food. And it always had this fantastic cafe in that you could go and have lunch in. You could have your Christmas lunch at Christmas. It was part of people's routine. So when we think about back to the early 80s, we didn't have out-of-town shopping centres. They kind of came into the mix in the mid-80s. So city centres and town centres were the place to go shopping, and we'd tend to go weekly on a Saturday, and we would visit stores like C&A and stores like Woolworths and British Home Stores and Marks and Spencer. There wasn't very much choice when you look back on those times to where we are today. What's now happened is the world has changed spectacularly. We've changed as shoppers and the high street's changed. In fact, we haven't really got a high street anymore. So most of us shop out of town in retail parks or in big shopping centres where parking's free. And of course, the biggest change in shopping in the UK and in the world has been the introduction of internet shopping, which has changed the way that we behave. We've now got the ability to look at a market across the world for any item that we want to buy.
But clearly the world hadn't changed enough to deter Philip Green from buying BHS back at the turn of the millennium.
No, clearly not. And the headline on the BBC News website at the time said, BHS bought by M&S Raider, because Philip Green was at the time known mostly for a very recent failed attempt to buy Marks & Spencer. His purchase of BHS really launched him into the public consciousness. He bought it with mostly borrowed money. Stuart Lansley wrote an unauthorised biography of Philip Green, and he explained what Green did with the business next.
What he did at BHS is he went in there and tried to turn it round, not by improving the quality of the stock or the look of the stores or trying to modernise what was a very outdated company, but essentially by squeezing costs. He turned down the lights in all the stores in order to save, you know, £200,000 a year on electricity bills. He squeezed his suppliers. So he called in his suppliers one by one, typically would get them to display their products around his room, put the fear of God into them, and then said, how much are you charging me for this? And then he'd throw a little bit of a fit and say, well, I'm not paying that. And so what he did is he sort of renegotiated virtually every supplier contract. This, of course, is absolutely common practice in business now. All the supermarkets do it. But he was one of the first to really squeeze the suppliers in a big way. So what he did at BHS for the first 2 years was a mix of financial engineering, squeezing costs, hurting suppliers, but he didn't expand sales.
Now, in the early years of his ownership, Philip Green paid out dividends out of BHS profits, hundreds of millions of pounds of dividends. But at the time, the company, because of that cost-cutting and squeezing, was very profitable. With the success of BHS and all that profit, Sir Philip went on to buy the Arcadia Group, including the brands Topshop, Miss Selfridge, and a whole shelf full of others.
Now, there's that famous story I seem to recall, when a few years later he paid himself and his family, what was it, £1 billion, even more actually, in dividends from that overall business.
Yeah, that's right. And let's just be clear, that was from Arcadia, the big group. BHS wasn't part of that deal. But BHS, as Stuart Lansley indicates, wasn't really invested in for the long term. Those profits start to shrink and turn to losses, really hits the skids during the financial crisis. Here's Stuart Lansley again.
When you squeeze a company like that, but you don't invest for the long term, then it's inevitable a company is going to wither on the vine. And that's exactly what happened to BHS. It's perfectly clear that having taken the money, he effectively abandoned the company and it was always going to fail.
So the business suffers. And at the same time, and this is a key point, the company's pension fund starts to run into deficit.
But of course, the BHS pension fund is far from being alone there.
No. And quite a few company pension funds run into trouble at this time. During the credit crisis, investments are hit. At the same time, life expectancy has crept up, meaning people collect their pensions for longer. In the case of BHS, it's this perfect storm. The company's in decline. It has ballooning pension liabilities.
Now, we know that even before Sir Philip sold the company last year, the pensions regulator was looking into whether or not BHS could actually meet its pension obligations. We're going to hear more about the pension fund in a bit, because it hangs, I suppose the best phrase is, like a storm cloud over the deal that eventually was struck.
Yeah, and here's a detail that puts Green in a slightly better light. He did leave a lot of cash in the business when he sold it, and he wrote off lots of debt, more than £200 million. And of course, he sold the business for a nominal amount, £1.
Now, the question must be asked, despite those incentives you've just outlined, who would buy an ailing company that not even King Retail himself could make work? There wasn't much of a queue, was there?
Well, no, not a queue. But we do know that there was an offer on the table from a former retail director of BHS, an experienced retail businessman who'd worked under Philip Green and who had the backing of some big private equity firms. Now, we spoke to a couple of the people who were close to that deal. None of them wanted to go on the record.
Yeah, it's a shame they won't go on the record. But in any case, it doesn't matter because along came...
Well, another group called Retail Acquisitions. Now, that company was owned by a man named Dominic Chappelle. Newspaper stories at the time almost invariably call Chappelle little known or unknown. They just don't know much about him.
Okay, so we've got these two offers. One from a former associate who apparently knows the retail business pretty well, has worked in it for quite a long time. And the other from a complete group of unknowns. And it goes to the unknowns.
Yes, that's right. Now, we have heard from the people we were talking to various accounts of what was on the table in terms of both offers. But it does appear that from Philip Green's perspective, the better deal came from Retail Acquisitions, that unknown group. Under that deal, Green would stand to lose less in debt, write-offs, other details were involved. So that's the deal he accepted.
So, a little over a year ago, BHS is bought by this relatively obscure business headed by the unknown Dominic Chappelle. It seems like an odd question, but what do we know about him other than nothing?
Well, we've found out a few things since then. We know he's an ex-racing car driver. He went bankrupt three times. Still, there did seem to be a plan to get BHS out of the doldrums. Retail Acquisitions appointed a chief executive, Darren Topp, who was a Philip Green protege. And last year, Darren Topp spoke to Radio 4's You and Yours about his turnaround plan for the company.
It's all about women's wear. If you get women's wear right, the rest of it will follow. That's the truth. Our key target customer, that modern working mum, mid-40s, got children, hence every store you'll see will lead with our women's wear offer.
That's who your customer is then, a mum, early 40s. You think that she wants to do everything under one roof?
We spent a lot of time talking to current customers, talking to potential customers. What's been clear from that feedback is that she's time poor, she's working, she's looking after the family, looking after the home, and what she wants is the convenience of a sort of one-stop shop.
I guess the question there is why that busy working mum wouldn't just shop online or maybe go to the supermarket out of town. But anyway, in hindsight, the changes weren't nearly enough to save the business. In fact, some people said it was hard to tell that anything had been done to the shops at all. Retail expert Catherine Shuttleworth.
I think it was very difficult to see how their retail plan was actually being executed. There didn't seem to be a route through to trade that business into the future. Much discussion was around rent reductions, if they tried to get rent reduction on 87 of the 164 stores. They cut their head office and store jobs to reduce costs. Reducing costs would be sensible, but in all retail businesses, as you reduce costs, you also need to increase sales. And it was very difficult to see what the sales driving strategy was.
This is The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich, looking at British home stores. Back to you, Mike. Now, whatever was happening in the shops themselves, something definitely seemed to be happening in the company's balance sheet, didn't it? It's been reported that more than 25 million quid was taken out of BHS and given to Retail Acquisitions in the form of salaries, management fees, legal fees and other costs. It wasn't illegal or anything, but all the same.
Sure, and now the company has run out of cash. Last month, BHS went into administration. There are now a few different companies and people who have bids on the table. The deadline was Tuesday for those. But in the meantime, the Insolvency Service, which is responsible for investigating company failures, has started a fast-track investigation. And the pensions regulator has started an investigation as well. Next month, Philip Green and Dominic Chappelle will appear in front of parliamentary committees to answer questions.
Yeah, some of them from MPs who don't seem to like Philip Green very much, as does almost no one else if you read the papers. It probably doesn't help that he's just bought his third yacht. I should mention here that we invited both Sir Philip Green and Dominic Chappelle to step into the briefing room, but neither took up the offer. Green has made it clear who he's pointing the finger at, though. He says, if I give you my plane right and you tell me that you're a great driver and you clash it into the first, and my script says bleeping mountain, is that my fault?
Yeah, and there are actually a few credible voices that are backing Sir Philip up on this point. They say he's a great pilot, even if the plane has crashed. Earlier, I spoke to Paul Scott. He's a popular blogger for Stuckopedia.com.
Really, in my view, without Philip Green's involvement, this business probably would have gone bust a number of years earlier. I think he re-energised it. Certainly for the last 4 years of its life, he was financially supporting the business. The accounts were only signed off by the auditors because the parent company gave effectively a guarantee to continue supporting the business. So I would actually look at it the opposite way around to most commentators and say this business survived years longer under Philip Green's ownership than it probably otherwise would have done.
Now, Paul Scott has looked at the balance sheets. He says that the amount of money Green lost when selling the company is about the same as the amount that he took out of the company in dividends during those high profit years. He's not alone in that view. I've heard other people say the same thing.
Well, that's kind of a bit odd because there are plenty of other estimates saying that the amount of money that Green took from the business was much, much bigger.
Yeah,
than that.
That's right. And what a lot of those estimates that are in the business pages take into account is rents paid to the Arcadia Group as part of a sale and leaseback of BHS shops. Various fees, including management fees paid to the Arcadia Group.
Now, I always think of management fees, Mike, as sort of one of those sort of things that can mean almost anything. What are management fees for?
Well, in this case, it's the parent company, Arcadia Group, charging BHS for things like distribution, warehouse space, this kind of stuff. Now, remember, Arcadia and BHS are both controlled by Philip Green, so the money is effectively just going from one part of his empire to another. And Paul Scott says those fees on the balance sheet look pretty big.
I'd ask for a breakdown of the management charges charged by Arcadia to BHS. It probably wouldn't have made any difference to the outcome, but I think we should certainly look at whether those numbers are reasonable.
Now, of course, Mike, if they conclude they're not, what they're effectively saying is that this was a kind of ploy whereby Philip Green got one part of his business to pay another part of his business.
A bit of financial engineering, maybe.
As we've hinted, one potential motive for selling BHS was to get away from its huge pension liabilities. In fact, the pensions regulator opened up an anti-avoidance investigation into Philip Green just after the sale in 2015. An anti-avoidance investigation, Mike, what is it?
Well, companies have a responsibility, a duty to fund their pension schemes. And if companies or individuals are apparently trying to get around those obligations, then that's where the pensions regulator steps in and sees if there is avoidance that's going on. That investigation in terms of BHS and Philip Green is ongoing.
I'm David Aronovich. This is The Briefing Room, and joining Mike Wendling and me in it are Jeremy Quinn, Conservative MP and member of the Work and Pensions Committee, and John Ralph, a pensions consultant and a former head of corporate finance at Boots, and now a specialist advisor to the Work and Pensions Committee hearings into BHS. John Ralph, I'll come to you first. Last year you said, this is before anything about administration came up, about the sale of BHS, this one will come back to bite Philip Green. Why did you think that?
It was very clear, and it's even clearer having listened to all the other people you have in the programme, that this was a company that was in difficulty. I think Philip Green knew it was a company that was in difficulty. What was he trying to do? He was trying to extricate himself from it as quickly, as easily and as neatly as possible. I think the route that he chose is probably getting him to more trouble than the alternative. And it's very easy with me with hindsight saying what he should have done. But I think if he had said, I'm not capable of running this business. Nobody else is capable of running this business. Nobody has the money to invest in it, and we've heard that a lot of investment is necessary. what is the right thing to do? The right thing to do is to wind this company down, to do that in conjunction with the pension regulator, to explain to the pension regulator what's happening, and to oil the wheels, put an amount of money into the pension scheme. Now, it's not for me to say the amount of money that would have to go into the pension scheme, but I guess it would have been, I know it would be a lot less than the 571 million figure that we're talking about today.
So that's more or less what it was that you were foreseeing a year ago. Right now, the pension fund is staring at a deficit of more than £500 million. Now, as things stand currently, as the law now is and as regulation now is, how much can Sir Philip Green be forced to pay?
The law is very unclear, and anybody who says it's easy and it's black and white and this will all be over by Christmas is just wrong. The pensions regulator hasn't been around for very long, been around for about 10 years. There are very few cases, anti-avoidance cases, that the regulator has pursued. Some of those are still going on because it goes through the various levels of the court. The ones that have been settled, in most cases outside of the court, are a state secret. We don't actually know what happened. So the answer to your question is, I don't know. What I do know is that the pension regulator will be putting a case to make a claim against, and let's be very clear, the phrase is connected parties, and we do need to be very clear that there is no demonstrable legal liability on the part of the Tabata Group towards the BHS
Tabata
pension.
Group being one of the green companies.
Yes, which... yes. In fact, it's the holding company. It's the company that owned BHS and sold BHS. The whole thing is much, much less clear.
So it's a bit like some of the discussions you sometimes hear about the HMRC and tax liabilities. You think there's some kind of law about this, but actually, in the end, it's about negotiation.
I think negotiation comes at a fairly late stage in the proceedings. Say that there is something called the Determinations Panel, which is the first legal step, well-staffed with good economists, good accountants, good lawyers. They will take their time, quite rightly take their time. I think your analogy of the HMRC route is absolutely right in practice, David.
Now, you wrote fairly recently, and it really struck me, that BHS, you said, does look like a return to the bad old days when companies could walk away from underfunded pension schemes with the new twist of being able to dump them into PPF, into the protection scheme. That's a very, very strong statement and a big warning to the public and to Parliament about what can now happen.
Yes, there's a bit of rhetorical flourish in there, as you might expect, David. I'm old enough, you're old enough, we're all old enough to remember the bad old days when there were people marching up and down Whitehall saying, well, hang on a minute, I thought my pension was protected. This is what I was being told. The government acted and I've got to choose my words carefully here. I think what they came up with wasn't actually very strong, and perhaps we're seeing that today. But the headline was, this sort of thing can never happen again. We have put a stop to it. And the pension regulator, in some ways, I think, has oversold itself. The pension regulator's powers are simply not as tough as most people think.
Well, that's a perfect point to go to you, Jeremy Quinn. Is John Ralph right about that?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for what John was saying. But one point I would pick up with him, though, and he's right in saying how complex these situations are. But in referring to a wind down of BHS, I mean, there are 11,000 employees involved. These are very difficult calls. And part of the tension we have with the existing pension schemes, there are 6,000 defined benefit schemes out there. There are 11 million members of them. There is a tension between existing employees and the ability to honour promises to pensioners.
And in this case, there's 20,000 BHS members of the BHS pension scheme.
Absolutely right. David, you did ask me about John's thoughts, and I think it is the PPF is an invaluable tool. Prior to the PPF coming in 2005, and prior to that point, you had more ability to be looked after if you were missold a holiday than if your company went bust and you were owed a pension. So the PPF fulfills a very valuable role. The important thing about our inquiry is making certain that the regulator will help ensure that pensions are kept in good order on an ongoing basis.
Well, let's come to precisely that. I mean, you were questioning the pensions regulator on Monday. And I have to say, you didn't sound entirely convinced that in the case of the reporting from BHS about the plan that they had to cover the pensions deficit, or indeed the information they'd given the regulator about an impending sale, you didn't sound at all convinced that actually she'd been dealt in to the information she needed to do her job.
There will be thousands of documents wending their way to the regulator, and I don't see those, and it's not our committee's job to investigate those documents. So I was asking the regulator about the nature of the conversations they have in these circumstances, and that is important because they have a lot of flexibility, but it's important that we all have confidence in what the regulator can do.
Sure, but the key word that you used in that question, it really stuck out for me, was respect. You were saying essentially that the regulator deserved a degree of respect from the company. You then went on to say you were doing things, we don't know what they are, you didn't expect to know, but you're doing things over that period. It shows a marked lack of respect that you read about this, i.e. what BHS were doing in the sale, in the papers. All we are talking about, you said, is a telephone call, to which, as you recall, the regulator, Leslie Titcombe, said, indeed. Now, what did you take from that, indeed?
I think there's been some clarification over the last 24 hours as to what the nature of the discussions were between the regulator and the other parties involved. But a key point that I would pick up on in this whole area is that there needs to be a degree of respect, even fear, for the regulator. It's incredibly important. They can be flexible in how they exercise their powers. They do have powers, but
and
we all need to have that
risk? Do you think there is that fear at
that
the moment?
That is one thing that we are going to be looking into.
OK, let me put it a different way. Are you worried that there might not be?
I am concerned to ensure that the regulator is held in a proper degree of respect when it comes to honouring commitments to be made to pensioners.
May I put it to you,
incredibly important given...
Of course, but may I put it to you that you'd hardly be concerned about it if you thought it already existed and was not a problem?
It has to be the case that with the number of defined benefit schemes, five-sixths of which are currently not in surplus, there's a deficit out there, that you have to be... pension trustees and sponsors need to make certain that they are looking to honour their commitments to pensioners.
Now, I have a horrid suspicion that I know what you're going to say in response to this next question, but the chairman of your committee said, in advance of any hearings at all, that unless Sir Philip Green effectively paid £571 million to cover the pension deficit, he should relinquish his knighthood. Now, I don't imagine that you're going to go even remotely that far, but is there a kind of perception that you would share in any way that there is indeed some form of moral liability there?
For every sponsoring employer, they have commitments that they make to pensioners. And it's important that those commitments are uppermost in boards of directors' minds, and they deal with their trustees. That's incredibly important. But I'm not going to get into BHS. It's being investigated by the regulator. We've got hearings to be held. So I'm not going to go anywhere near BHS specifics.
At a more general level, I put back to John Ralph his quote about returning to the bad old days when companies could walk away from underfunded pension schemes. Do you in any way share that worry?
I do get concerned if a situation developed in which companies felt that they could take up that option. We are, at one point, which didn't come out in your report, we have extraordinarily low levels of interest rates at the moment. That accentuates pension liabilities. We cannot get into a situation where good companies are being forced under because of the nature of their liabilities. We don't want to go there. That can't be allowed to happen. There are many people who are being employed as well as pensioners to be looked after. But it's a matter of dealing responsibly and ensuring we have a regulator that has the powers and has the respect to ensure that they can help keep those pension funds in good order.
John Ralph, what do you make of that?
I don't think company boards lie awake night worried about what the regulator is going to do to them.
And you think they should?
I think they should. I don't think that's entirely the fault of the regulator. I mean, the way I put it is that the rules are weak. The rules could be enforced strongly, but as a matter of fact, they're enforced weakly. So you have weak rules being enforced weakly, and that's a recipe for problems.
Mike, a last one to you. What do you think will happen in the end of this debacle?
Well, soon we'll hear who has won the bid to get BHS out of administration. And we'll find out what happens to the future of the company. Of course, there's going to be more questions to be answered next month in front of the committees.
That's it. Mike Wendling, Jeremy Quinn, John Ralph and I have to vacate the briefing room until next week. But if you want to remain fully briefed on the big issues of the day, subscribe to our podcast. And to do that, you just search for The Briefing Room online. We'll be back next week. Goodbye.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.